And I shall come to this question, word border, later on, that even this word border itself signifies so many contests around it. Now, recall Lord Curzon's use of the word frontier when he said that empires or states can be governed properly when beyond the border you have what you call as frontiers. And this was his main argument, that the frontiers need to be properly understood in order to build a stable state. If you read Etienne Balibar, for example, he speaks of Europe as borderland. Whereas if you read William Van Schandel's very famous book of Bengal borderlands, which speaks of Bengal border, Bangladesh border, borders of Northeast, Myanmar, he says that border is nothing or mainly a space on either side of the people to live, labor, trade, and survive in spite of or not in the midst of many difficulties. And histories of friendship and enmity, they have given birth, therefore, both to anti-immigrant words as well as words of accommodative gestures. So in short, what I am arguing is that precisely because certain words are minor words, we require, when we try to understand why apparently these minor words become crucial in understanding the evolution of refugee and migration studies, that we need to dig into their histories and their journey into the status of becoming keywords. Secondly, these keywords are not standard in their meanings, or they cannot be standardized. They are contested in every sense of the word, as I showed with regard to a phrase called cities of refuge, or this word called border. And finally, it also shows that because these words are traveling, as I said in the beginning, they are words in motion. Therefore, the formation of these words is marked with deep and irredeemable fault lines. Keywords in migration and refugee studies are bound to remain mostly minor because the reality that produces these words globally, nationally, regionally, and locally is marginal to mainstream governance. Governance of migration is usually only one part of the entire range of governance. Whereas if you look at from some of the words which are called keywords in migration studies and refugee studies, this is a kind of a different optic through which you can see the implications of the range of governance. Otherwise, let us say when my dear friend Radha and others, we were working on partition, if you read, let us say, migration literature of the 50s, 60s, 70s, you'd have to dig hard to find out this word partition in refugee and migration studies, unless, again, you are studying certain specific periods. Otherwise, in the general vocabulary of migration studies, this remains a minor word. But the moment you enter the history of that word, you are actually thereby digging a much more deeper, but a much more expansive history of the same. Or let us say statelessness. Read any standard book of citizenship. You will not find the word statelessness. On the other hand, statelessness, which is a minor word in the history of citizenship, the moment you use that word as an optic, you will find that it has opened up another reality, which is that statelessness, even though the UNHCR says and the global community says that it has a positive definition, recall the 1954 Convention on Statelessness and the 62 Convention on Reduction of Statelessness, but statelessness is always seen in terms of a positive definition, as if there are positive markers of what is statelessness. It is never seen as a refraction of what we call citizenship, which is a much more important and mainstream word. So keywords are written with fault lines. And it is important, and I think it is high time, that we recall this famous book by Raymond Williams on keywords in culture. Raymond Williams wrote in the introduction to his famous Keywords, published first in 1976, a strange line he writes in the introduction, within quote, "The fact is, I realized people just don't speak the same language," unquote. And Williams continued, "When we come to say we just don't speak the same language, we mean something more general, that we have different immediate values of different kinds of valuation, or that we are aware often intangibly of different formations and distributions of energy and interest. In such case, each group is speaking its native language, but its uses are significantly different, and especially when strong feelings are important or important ideas are in question." As an instance, and this is crucial, Raymond Williams pitchforked the word culture and savaged the word to show that words are not innocent. And I'm quoting Raymond Williams. He says, "But I found myself preoccupied by a single word, culture. I had heard it previously in two senses, one at the fringes, in tea shops and places like that, where it seemed the preferred word for a kind of social superiority, not in ideas or learning, and not only in money or position, but in a more intangible area relating to behavior. Yet also, secondly, among my own friends, where it was an active word for writing poems and novels, making films and paintings, working in theaters. What I was now hearing were two different other senses, which I could not really get clear. First, in the study of literature, a use of the word to indicate powerfully, but not explicitly, some central formation of values, and that literature itself had the same kind of emphasis. And secondly, what is more important, in more general discussion, but with what seemed to me having a very different implication, a use which made it almost equivalent to society, as if culture is society, a particular way of life, as we say, American culture, Japanese culture," unquote. Williams here was not only alluding to words as carriers of multiple meanings and contexts, words are contributing to, as he said, some central formation of values, and as next step, they're effacing the value question to become equivalent to society. He said, "I found that the connections I was making and the area of concern which I was attempting to describe were in practice experienced and shared by many other people, but often in conflicting ways. Meanings are more than therefore significations." Hence, Raymond Williams adopted a cluster approach to show the networks of meanings and affiliations of words. He, as we know, put out these groups at the outset of his book. I believe Raymond Williams' Keywords brings out the collective nature of this enterprise. Coming back to the question of statelessness, a word which doesn't occur in citizenship studies, I still remember how nearly a decade back, and I'm speaking of my own experience, the UNHCR's Delhi office, their eyebrows were raised when they found that the discussions and studies of statelessness in South Asia were made in the context of citizenship practices. The Geneva-based wisdom, as one of my colleagues put it, of law faced post-colonial realities. UNHCR's preferred view was that statelessness had a clear, in other words, positive definition given the UN Convention relating to status of stateless persons of 1954 and the subsequent Convention on Reduction of Statelessness 1961. In other words, statelessness could be and should be defined by a set of criteria and not as an absence or lack of citizenship. Yet the fact remains that citizenship as an institution always, what Etienne Balibar, he had used the word, it's a very enigmatic but very productive word, which is it incompletes itself. The word cannot complete itself in its meaning. It's a word that will always be incomplete in the achievement of its full meaning. And therefore, statelessness, according to the same line of thinking, is the name of a lack, an incompletion. Statelessness is the name of a condition which functions as a permanent critique of citizenship. What happens if you invest these words, and I'm now shortening because we had lost some time, but what happens when you invest these words, which are apparently minor, but they are extremely disruptive in their capacity to interrogate our mainstream knowledges? What happens when you invest these words with life and activity? You cannot but realize that the power of these words draws from their collective body, made as if of flesh, blood, bones, and muscles, words as collective, and each word as a collective of meanings. And hence, as scientists, you must work as a group, a team, to check the histories of the parts that have gone into making this body, in other words, a word which is we take as keywords as a life entity. While preparing keywords, again, to go back to Raymond Williams, he admitted that his selection of keywords was arbitrary, which is natural, but omissions may be very costly. As scholars have pointed out, you read Raymond Williams' keywords, you do not find the word border there. You do not find the word migration there. And today, if someone had to prepare a keyword, it is unimaginable that they would leave the word migration when discussing the keywords on culture. In short, I will just refer three, four lines to the question of border. The word border shows how territory and its associated institutions work together as an assemblage of meanings. While we traditionally think of borders as inscribed onto maps in which discrete territories are separated by lines and colors, this imagination is never clean and without complications. This is because borders always denote passages of people, information, money, commodities, cultural and social artifacts. So border would indicate not only border that demarcates, but border would indicate also crossing or passing, which would mean mobility. Yet you can see that when you think of mobility, mobility can be achieved only when it crosses a hurdle. Otherwise, you cannot imagine what mobility is all about. So border and crossing, if you pair these two words, you can see points to a third notion, which we have termed as mobility. And the notion is certainly one of citizenship. It began, as we know, citizenship with rights and sovereignty of people. But today, citizenship is not associated with these things. Citizenship is associated with your identity. What will then happen to people who have achieved mobility by crossing the hurdle? Again, this is a question which we may think about. But think of the way, as I referred to Lord Curzon, who in 1907, in his famous Romanist lecture, spoke of frontier as a reality to be managed in order to impart stability to colonial governments. In short, frontier is an inherently unruly situation to be governed. On the other hand, if you read Mehnaz Esfahani's 1989 work, the same frontier, Roads and Rivals, in the name of the book, becomes the battleground for rivalry, migration, and new order. You speak to a critical scholar of Africa, you will hear again a different story and a different meaning of border in terms of the history of state making in sub-Saharan Africa following the border making and boundary delimitation policies of European colonial powers in 1884 following the Berlin Congress. And today, you read the work of a feminist historian, you will see other kinds of approaches to border which will deal with women's lives, women as entities on the border. So shifts are always happening in terms of meanings of words which we take as keywords. New words are added to the vocabulary. Take a word, solidarity. You, 1 minute more and I finish. Take the word solidarity. Usual refugee studies and migration studies, you would not find the word. But today, there are books coming out that are telling solidarity is a concept that should replace sovereignty in migration studies. Mm-hmm. Or the word girmitia. I do not know how many people in Europe would be familiar with the term. Now, this word, it's a long forgotten word, girmitia. Etymologically, it is derived from the word girmit, which would mean agreement in colloquial Indian Hindi language. As Indians had pronounced agreement as girmit. Indentured laborers who were transported to work in places like Fiji and Mauritius became therefore known as girmitians. Or as I said, a recurring word like partition. These words are keywords in refugee and migration studies. They are minor, but they point to the violent nature of the origin of modern migration process, its colonial and post-colonial nature. Words are therefore vacillating in meaning, hence the need to capture words in motion, or these meanings in motion. The last reference to, again, Raymond Williams. Raymond Williams, in his book Keywords, annotated with more than one entry the word humanity when he wanted to annotate that word as a keyword in studies of culture. And he said, this word belongs to a complex group of words, a word which is belonging to a complex group of words, including 5 entries on humanity. One is human. Second is humane. Third is humanism. Fourth is humanist. And the fifth is humanitarian. And to explicate why the word humanity is a keyword in culture, he had to use 5 words in the entries. As if we need cameras all around, far off traces suddenly come alive and become vivid, like the word camp. In India, we used to hear of shelter camps, food distribution camps, army camps, and now suddenly, in the wake of the citizenship registration drive, we are hearing camps for those whose status have been declared as alien. In other words, we find the images of our own histories in certain words which we consider as keywords. These histories reappear before us as independent objects of society, objectified as words, even though they were produced by ourselves, but now they become independent object. Thank you. Sorry for taking a little more time.
Well, thank you very much indeed. And we have to apologize for the full start, but here we are now. What I suggest is perhaps to go from the left to the right, starting with Catherine Vidal de Vendel, Marie-Caroline Saglio, Flora Gubert, Professor Casimir Poor, and Rada Ivekovic. Perhaps one way to enter the conversation would be to ask you, what are your keywords?
Yes, thank you.
According to the type of study you conduct, some of you very general, some of you more focused on a specific geographical area or not. And of course, being where we are, which is both in France, where we hear that perhaps after the glorious episode of rearmament, we may have now a debate on migration, or in Europe, where we're also and where a couple of days ago in Parliament, the European MPs voted on the question to know if the share of migrants coming to Italy were to be a burden to be distributed to various countries. And here, interestingly, but not surprisingly, the French Rassemblement National voted against. When, of course, in Italy, the party of Mrs. Meloni voted for, which means, of course, that if you are nationalists, you may share opposition to migration, but your policy could be different if you are from one side or the other side of the border. So, Catherine, perhaps?
Thank you. Thanks to give me the possibility to begin this conversation with my colleagues and especially with Ranabir Samada. So I shall perhaps say before trying to reply to your question, what are your words in migration studies? I shall say that the words we use now are not the words we used in the past. For example, for migration studies in the past, in the 50s and 70s, the keyword was travailleurs étrangers, foreign workers. So there was a special insight and the idea to stress on the notion of work, because the migrant was mostly a worker, and in the also Marxist approaches, the worker was a very, there were many important discussions about which were their role in the working class for migrants, and also the notion of foreigner, because these foreigners had a different status from the nationals. And perhaps in this period, the divide was more between the nationals and foreigners than now, where we use preferably the term of migrant, which is stressing on mobility. Second, I shall so the use of the words differs according to the various periods. The idea I shall follow some keywords used by Ranabir. The idea of shock, we don't use a lot is the notion of shock in European studies, but more of crisis, even if the crisis does not exist. There are a lot of books, mostly the recent book of François Héran says there is no migration crisis. There are crises mostly in south-south migrations, where the people in exile are welcomed by other southern countries, mostly at world level. But in Europe, there is no migration crisis because the part of those welcomed in Europe is very small compared with the part welcomed by southern countries now. So there is no crisis, but the topic of crisis is politically very important. It is used by many extreme rightist parties, and not just extreme rightist parties at European level, governance especially. So there are plenty of migration, supposed migration crisis with the welcoming of refugees in 2015, but also after the COVID crisis and in many other examples, the Ukrainian crisis now. But in most cases, there is no crisis. But the use, the political use is very important. The notion of border is very important in our studies. I am a political scientist, and so the notion of border is hinting at sovereignty. Who decides? Who decides for the welcoming of migrants? Who decides for citizenship? It is the nation state. Even if the nation state is very strongly challenged by mobility, by those who are crossing the borders, by those who don't enter totally inside the nation state order, the notion of border has been very strongly discussed, referring to migration. And as you were referring to Etienne Balibar, he's speaking about democratization of access to mobility as a hope, because he says now the problem, the crucial topic of citizenship is very important for the access to rights, access to full citizenship, participation, and there are now a lot of hierarchized forms of citizenship, from the stateless people to those who are full citizens, with very different definition of citizenship. I wanted to speak about Thomas Hammer's notion of denizens, those who are denied full citizenship, but who are partly participants at local level, for example. And also citizenship refers not necessarily to nationals. Thanks to migration, there has been a strong dissociation between nationals and citizens in their participation and also access to rights, especially in the European case. But this hierarchization of citizenship, including the illegal population, which are a strong part of migration at world level, are included in this hierarchy of various forms of citizenship according to their rights and according to their negotiation, participation, and so on. As for the notion of mobility, it is very important. It is one of the key words in order to decide about governance. Which governance do we underline? Speaking about migration, most researchers and other academics are stressing on the importance of mobility in order to rule migration. But we are not heard by many political actors, by political decisions, because they are still stuck to the nation state. And for them, the nation state is more important than the entrance into mobility of the world. The world has entered into mobility, and the resistance is which role for the state in this discussion about mobility, which is a crucial point now. Temporary mobility or settlement for a longer time, which citizenship for those who are mobile compared with those who are stable populations, for example. It is a very important topic. The right to move is also a very important discussion in migration studies. And I shall end with solidarity. Solidarity has been used especially for refugees. Now there is a kind of confusion, floating words between migrants and refugees, especially in Europe, because it will be perhaps in the debate if we close the migration of work, there are more candidates to refugee status. And so we are more and more words which are moving, and it is sometimes very difficult to make a very strong distinction between workers, migrant workers, between asylum seekers, family reunification, unaccompanied minors, and so on. They are all migrants, but the categories which are fitting to their situation, as recognized or not, as refugees, are workers, are family reunification students, are more and more floating. Because most of these people are aiming mostly at mobility, whatever the status they try to apply for. Let's stop here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Indeed. Marie-Caroline, you may have something to say on keywords, because some of your recent books address, I translate the voice of those who felt about asylum seekers, and one of the book which is there is titled Lingua non grata, Language, Violence and Resistance in the Space of Migration. So you are very much at the heart of the issue, isn't it?
Thank you, Jean-Luc. Catherine did a very brilliant answer, so I'm going to ask the question in a very different way. I think your question is political and methodological. I'm an anthropologist, and I've been trying also as the director of this center, Jean-Luc talked about, which is the ICM, l'Institut Convergence Migration, which is a pluridisciplinarity collaborative institute gathering more than 600 fellows working in migration studies, and gathering 8 institute and university. There is one of our aim is definitely to work on categorization and keywords, because what you call categorical boundaries in your book, The Postcolonial Age of Migration, these categorical boundaries exert a violence on the subjects and close them, homogenize them. And the perversity of these categories, of some of these keywords, is that they affect the very way of apprehending the real. Beside this, there is today a plurality of discourse which are antinomic, polysemic. There is a political discourse, an administration of asylum discourse, a psychiatric discourse, a humanitarian discourse, and they do not meet. So one of the research aim is to try to is to challenge those words, those keywords which produce knowledge about migration, and have the adequate language, and try also to take into account the dual construction of meaning and social context, which is a praxeological conception of languages. Okay, I'm not only an anthropologist, I'm also a clinician psychologist. And then the question of languages is totally different. And the question of words is totally different. And when you've been talking about culture, I was moved, because as an anthropologist today, to question migrants, I cannot use the culture world. You are immediately a culturalist a communitarian in something. But as a psychologist, I can use all the day the question of culture, which is another question. And I would like to share an interesting research we've been doing, and Jean-Luc just present this book, which is Lingua Non Grata. We've been trying to answer the question of language and dominant categories and dominant keywords, which are the result also of a colonial and post-colonial sphere and academic research. We've been trying to answer this critique by another kind of research from the field, from the praxis of languages. We've been working for a few years with more than 50 exiles, were researchers, mediators, translators, anyway, who were talking, who were speaking the language of migration we meet in France, which is a lot of different Arabics, Syrian or Sudanese Arabics, Urdu, Pashto, Dari. We had more than 20 languages. And we went on the camps in the borders, and there we've been trying to do we've been trying to collect, which is a totally arbitrary collection, the words we were hearing, the main words, the 2000 main words we've been hearing. We didn't choose them, we just hear them. So it's an oral experience, and the major variable is the frequency. And we've been doing a platform from this experience, which is the platform of the words of what is the language we speak on a camp today in France, which is a multilingual camp, which is very much determined by the emergency situation, by the the political situation, but which is also a share of a specific condition, which is the condition of the exile today. So we've been trying to see here and to go beyond the language as the site of the subalternization today. We are trying to reverse this this whole question. So this would be my main answer. I would have liked to speak about the taxonomies, but I think that you're going to talk about it.
Yeah, thank you. This is a very, very nice introduction. Maybe we need to use the computer. Okay, so again, I was not, I think Catherine indeed mentioned, I mean, did answer very nicely your question. And so if I may, I will do a little digression and then go back to these taxonomies that Marie-Caroline just mentioned. This digression is about something we've been working on for a few weeks now, which is the idea of having a platform in order to concentrate all the knowledge on migration, whatever the language in which this knowledge is. So let me go back maybe to our starting point. So our starting point is actually some reflexive work conducted by social scientists and critical geographers in particular on the production and dissemination of knowledge within migration studies. So what is made clear in this work is that the strong dominance of English in terms of authorship, others' affiliation, context under study, theories arising, makes certain strands of migration scholarship totally invisible. And this linguistic hegemony creates some strong inequalities and exclusion within the academic world, as it contributes to marginalize approaches and research developed in other places and languages, among which those originating from countries of the South. And this clearly structures power relation within the field of migration scholarship, and in a sense gives rise to a division of intellectual labor, with most migration theoretical contributions being in English and originating from scholars located in the global north, and empirical data or case studies being found in the global south. And this strongly influences how questions are asked, how research is conducted. This also influences the concepts themselves. And this also results in different spaces of research, quite some kind of silos, if I may say, in which the working language is not English, but rather Spanish, Portuguese, French, or Arabic, Russian, and the list could be much longer, that are often built on past colonial links, as is the case for France, with its former colonies and protectorates. And just to give you a very brief illustration of these linguistic bias, Jorgen Carling, that I'm sure you all know, who's a research professor in migration studies at the Peace Research Institute Oslo, he drew a list of who's who in migration studies using as his main criterion of selection the number of papers published over the last 20 years in what he considers the leading migration journals. So we can, of course, question this criterion, but in the end, what he gets is nevertheless revealing, because in his list of 107 names, there is not one single person based in Africa or Latin America, only six people based in Asia, not a single person based in France, but respectively 30 and 23 people based in the US and in the UK. And I guess this raises several questions, but I will mainly focus on two questions, and which are of course very important. So how can different linguistic sphere of migration scholarship dialogue? Are there strategies possible for overcoming this linguistic hegemony and bring in particular non-Western perspectives to gain a better understanding of migration? And so this is where our platform is, I mean, this is what our platform is aimed at, right? So the spirit of this platform is to concentrate different, I mean, different knowledges coming from different parts of the world produced by researchers from southern country, right, in different languages, right, and to resemble this knowledge, right. And then the next question is, how can we, you know, navigate in these different clusters of knowledge in different languages? Shall we translate everything in a unique language? Shall we? So how can we help people to navigate? And here it comes to taxonomies, right? Because of course, one way to start organizing these different knowledges is to, you know, to use keywords and to classify the different papers, different projects, different data sets, whatever, you know, using these, put them in different categories using these keywords, right? But obviously keywords differ depending on where you, when you, you know, when you reside, when you where you are, right? So this is, you know, crucial. So we are back to the topic of our discussion, I think, right? So probably we will come back to this, but this is what I wanted to say on this topic. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor Kazemipo?
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Sommer, for great ideas. And I'm sort of trying to stretch your ideas to bring it to my own world in North America, in particular. I should mention that in Canada, the term and the discourses that are used, like upwards every other country, are split between a conservative camp and a liberal camp. So the terminology is used based on the political agenda of these different camps, and sometimes the same word is used with different meanings attached to it. But we also have another reality that perhaps this part is not like many other countries, and that's the fact that we have only one neighbor, and for better or worse, that's the United States. So we, that has become a sort of long time Canadian sensibility to distinguish themselves from Canada, from the United States. And so there are certain words that are used in Canadian context that their purpose is to distinguish us from American, to say that we are not American. So then we will have a sort of a two axis space when we want to analyze the Canadian terms, some that are sort of having a local and domestic nature, some that are along the line with this sort of continental divide that we are experiencing. So I will talk just very briefly about that continental divide. One pair of terms and words that are used in Canada that are much better known than more recent ones is that distinction between assimilation and integration. And Canadians are emphasizing that what is expected from immigrants, and indeed what is expected from the Canadian society in general, not just immigrants, is that they get integrated, not assimilated. And again, that is sometimes is meant exactly what the word means, but sometimes it is meant to say that we don't like the assimilation that Americans are suggesting. So sometimes there is no positive meaning attached to it, just a negative meaning that this is a non-American context. There is also another set of terms that are used to show that Canadians are not against refugees. So there are terms that like a new home, second homes, welcoming. These are becoming frequently used terms by the Canadian authorities, again, in order to show that they have a different approach to refugees than our neighbors to the south. In terms of the local dynamics, the pair of words and terms that are used are multiculturalism versus what the conservatives use, that emphasis on Canadian values as opposed to allowing for the multiplicity of values and cultural perspectives to coexist with each other. That is the Canadian part of my argument or my contribution. But I'm an Iranian Canadian, and I do research on both Canada and Iran on immigrants. And I want to add just a little bit on the Iranian context as well, because I have recently discovered a group or a population among the Iranian potential migrants that is totally missing in the discussions that are happening about immigration from south to north. And I have tried to sort of come up with a new term or concept for this population in order to give visibility to their experiences. And that's the subject of the book that I'm working on. Tentatively, I have called it Homo Emigratoris. And I want to sort of spend a couple of minutes on that because I think this is going to be a population or a group of people that need more attention. And they are related to the migration dynamics that is happening globally, and they are affected by migration trends and developments, but they are not a part of the discussion. Homo migratoris, which basically literally means those who are about to leave, those who are in that stage before migration. I have used that to refer to a large group of people that want to migrate, but they cannot. So normally, such people will give up their migration desire, migration idea after trying a few times, and then they realize that it's not possible, it's not doable. Then they go back to their previous life, abandoning the idea of migration. In certain environments when there is this huge urge to migrate, if there is a sort of culture of migration, they cannot do that very easily. So they have to stick to that idea of migration, even though they know that it's not going to happen. So they have to keep that idea alive in order to be able to survive, in order to be able to continue. And so they start living a dual life. And this becomes the life of someone who is not migrating, but is configurating his or her life exactly as if they are about to leave any moment. So they live in some sort of temporary situation, but in the process of
welcoming migration. Your last book is not exactly focused on this kind of conflict, if I believe its title, Epistemological Perspective on the Closure of Rich Countries.
So yeah, perhaps, but migration and.
Yes,
yeah.
Perhaps the keywords would be different.
maybe I should say. Start with saying just briefly that I'm a philosopher with my second life here in France, and I taught at philosophy at university. But I have a very strong linguistic background, and I have also in my first life studied India and Indian culture and history. So in his topic on keywords, Ranabir came to the topic of language and translation, also one could say. And I'm delighted with this because this is an important topic. When with Rana Bir some, how many years ago? 20 years ago? When we worked more than 20 years ago with Rana Bir and other friends, we worked on partitions compared. We actually knew and to some extent touched on the idea that a partition divides countries, but it divides minds and it divides language and languages. It separates languages. This is what was going on in the Balkans. This is what is going on now in Ukraine and what happened also in ago. And I'm also happy, Rana Bir, that you introduced this aspect of epistemology, of knowledge and where does knowledge come from and which knowledges we can use for which purposes. So an epistemological approach to migration is very important. And the aspect also of disciplinary distribution or prohibition also of words and keywords. Keywords are words, right? Keywords are words and they are also time dependent. Besides being mind dependent and political orientation dependent. So when they are translated, they may not have or keep the same meaning. They can be displaced. Meanings can be displaced. And this gives the whole problematic a very rich structure. Rana Bir says that keywords are words in motion. Yes, they are. This is very important. And being in motion means that they are not permanent. And that we have, as others have said, and Katrin also at the beginning, keywords, we do not use the same language describing migrations or, for that matter, any other social or political matter. We do not use the same words we used some years ago or that others used 100 years ago and so on. You talked about the imprint on keywords, the imprint of colonialism and post-colonialism. I believe that these are not the only imprints. You also mentioned some others. Then you mentioned, for example, how migration works and borders work for women. So we can assume that not only coloniality and post-coloniality, but patriarchy also would have an effect on the words we use. I would add something which can be called post-socialism since 1989, because this is a very important threshold that we have in history, colonialism and post-colonialism, which is still going on, but it is not the last threshold. We have this one too, post 1989, where actually the two post situations meet somehow, they intersect rather, post-socialism and post-colonialism in a way. And in both as in other phenomena of our times, there is something at work which is independent of the meanings we want to attribute to such and such a keyword. And this is what I call the desemantization of language, especially of political language. When you have change in the political configuration, you have a new situation, political and social situation. At a moment, there comes a time when old meanings are not of any use anymore, or old words are not used anymore, and you have new words coming in, as we saw. I felt this very, very strongly in 1989 in a double way, not only because I lived in a socialist country, Yugoslavia, which at that time was dismantled, and we lost all the references that we had from previous times and from our education, from our formation, from our social sciences, political sciences, philosophy, you name it. But also at the same time, because I came to France at the time of the war in Yugoslavia, to get away from that war, among other things. I met another set of references and another political vocabulary than the one I came with. Thank you. So work on language, yes, is always collective. It is always resistance, but there is no guarantee. There is no guarantee in working on language, even collectively, that we shall come to a consensus on the language to use, because that consensus is not possible in the end. But we can come near to it, and we can agree on plural meanings and multiple meanings and optional choices. There is, however, a limit to getting out of the mainstream language. Mainstream language is not always the colonial language, right? Any language can be a mainstream language locally. There are two limits. One is that there is no equality between languages. No equality between languages is possible because some are small languages and others are big languages, right? And they have different history. And the other thing is that the imprints on language that Ranabir was talking about, those imprints and impositions, be they colonial or other, are not permanent. They are not permanent. They will change in 20 years because language is a living organism. Language is a living organism. So when we deal collectively with language and try to build a zone of understanding through translation and other means in dealing with languages, you have translation also within one and the same language, right? When we deal with this, we agree in advance to the possibility that we shall not understand each other fully, right? And we must count with this element. There is no absolute translation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll take back the computer to see what message we have received eventually.
Yes, there was, if I may, there was one question that was asked to you in the chat. So you mentioned a shift in keywords over time, and the question is, to what extent do these shifts result from ideological struggles?
Yes, you can answer now, but after that we'll have questions from both the room and online. And I have myself one question to all of you, but you may answer this point first.
Yes, they are. I mean, the ideological contests are here, but I will not, give too much importance to the ideological contests. They are there, but let's say, take this word revolution. Now, revolution is a word probably taken from astronomy, probably taken from sciences, then in a major way with modern ideas, etc. So beginning or taking it from astronomical sciences, we spoke of revolution and now revolution of society. Now you have dress revolution, lipstick revolution, orange revolution. You can see the word revolution has, that's why I'm saying that they are words in motion. So ideology, I wouldn't say, is not there, but on the other hand, the using words is a very material practice. It's a material thing. And in the use of the word, therefore, practical struggles are involved, contests are involved. And the interesting part is that they are happening because of us. We are subjects, but we are always confronting the word as an object. It is something which is apart from us, different from us, out there as language, and we are using it. So ideological struggles and ideological contests are there, but I would again say that this factor is not to be personally, I speak that this is not to be too much balance I would give to that. I think that the other networks of meanings and shift and currency of meanings.
So thank you, Ranabir. Well, I'm interested by what you said because my question was not exactly on the same line. You have discussed about keywords practice by scholars, about keywords that you may find in the various languages of the migrants. What about the keywords of the anti-migrants? And can we disconnect the anti-migrants from the question of ideology? After that, we'll turn to the audience. So whoever has to say something about...
Yes, perhaps the most important keyword I heard in the last decades and debate is invasion. The notion of invasion, we are invaded. This word was used first by Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, speaking about invasion of by migrants, but the Rassemblement National is frequently speaking about invasion, and also Zemmour was frequently speaking about invasion, which could replace the natives. So it is a new approach of this invasion, and invasion also refers to the use, especially by governments, about the use of words which are words speaking about the sea. There are flows. There are new newcomers from the sea. And these words hint at something which cannot avoid, because it is the sea which is bringing this movement of populations.
Thank you. Anyone want to add something?
I think even though I was referring to the words that are that have anti-immigrant meanings. But for me, what is interesting is that most of the words cannot be clearly separated as words of enmity and words of friendship, or words of accommodation and words of hostility. But what is interesting, as scientists who are studying words, is that they are gray in their implications. Precisely because supposedly anti-immigrant strategies are most of the time used by the government as policies towards accommodating migrants. So this is a kind of what you would call the normalizing practice of a government in terms of controlling migration. So let us take this word assimilation or integration. The moment you ask a refugee group, you may in all probability find that this word, which is assimilation, used by the government, various departments, to say that we are actually accommodating the migrants, will be looked at by the immigrant groups as something which is a form of coercion, which are now we are being coerced into. So normalization is a strategy that actually covers up your ways of coercing people into ways which you think, which the people who those who govern think that that's necessary for running the government. Therefore, anti and pro, the usually what you find is that which was supposedly anti, the government tries to make it appear as if this is pro. So this is a kind of normalizing strategy where the clear shades of good and bad, pro and anti, they are.
Well, we have 20 minutes left.
I don't know the so, questions, maybe this.
Yes, there are questions. Yeah, please start.
It's all very interesting. Talking about keywords, I am about to publish some articles in Ottawa, that is to say in Canada, about the strategies of cultural participation by cultural centers, by towns, whatever, there is India, and well, more or less my topic, as I tell it, is participative strategies for people who are far away from cultural practice. And it was interesting to discuss with English and French. It was interesting to discuss with the Canadian publisher because he said, okay, you're talking about inclusion. So what do you think of this keyword?
Inclusion. Inclusion is a keyword that appeared maybe about 10, 15 years ago as a counterpoint to cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the cohesion was understood as something that has some sort of force behind it. It is mainstream population that is imposing it on others, and then in the name of cohesion, other things can be disregarded. And so it had a particular agenda by a particular group behind it. And so inclusion was started sort of to gain some currency as a counterpoint to that discourse of cohesion. But other than this sort of negative meaning to it, which is inclusion as non-cohesion, the positive side of it is not very clear, especially in a multicultural setting like Canada, because inclusion can be, and cultural participation that you mentioned, it could mean in the Canadian context, and can mean as a very legitimate thing to be done by immigrants, as participating in the cultural activities of your own group, not necessarily in the broader society. And or it could be, using the terminology that Robert Putnam suggests, it could be a sort of a bonding social capital kind of thing rather than a breaching one. So other than this negative aspect of it, the positive aspect of it can look at a wide range of activities, participatory cultural activities, some of which can promote integration, some of which can actually strengthen the isolation of some.
Thank you.
No more question from the floor. So the auditors who are online, you may open your mic if you have a specific question to ask either to Ranabir or a general question to the gathering. I repeat myself, perhaps? No, it's okay.
Maybe.
Yeah, so those who are following us online, you may open your mic if you have a question to the speakers.
I have to look the comments in the chat box.
I'm unable to read the screen, it's too far away.
No, I can see, but there's no question.
There's no question.
I just read the one that was...
Okay. So if there is no question, if we're online on the ground,
no question.
Perhaps everyone can have a word to add before concluding the panel. Oh, yes, please.
I'd like to hear some examples of the words you actually heard in those camps when you were examining what was coming out of this cohabitation of many languages and cultures on this camp.
Thank you for your question. Okay.
Thank you very much for your question. You can have access to all this platform. It's online. It's called migralect.org. Migralect, M-I-G-R-A-L-E-C-T, migralect, comme une langue. Okay. .org. So it's you have more than 2,000 words and expression. There are different kind of lexicon, and we've been trying to classify what we could hear. And we, as far as we were working with social linguists, anthropologists, psychologists, we've been trying also to explain the story of this word, because some of them are new words who come from migration itself, from the trajectories. Is that my point? Okay. Meaning that some of the people we can meet in these camps have been gone through many countries, and some of them, for example, Afghanis who came by Germany, catch some words and keep these new words inside the camps. So you have a lot of new kind of words, and you know. So there is a huge lexicon of non-translatable, you would say. Non, hein? Oui, intraduisible, which is the big word of Barbara Cassin, but here it has a very strong meaning. The words which are not translatable are the ones which are from the French administration. Récépissé, préfecture, is a word which only exists in France, as far as a préfecture has not the same meaning in Sudan, you know. Minority is a totally, for example, is a legal word which is very strong to understand. So you have this whole range of words which is very difficult to understand. And what is very interesting for an anthropologist working also with administration of exile and administration is that these kind of words are the ones which are used by the French administration refugee system to protect the refugee. I've been working in the CNDA, in the court, for the Cour nationale des droits d'asile, or the OFPRA. And you know, there is a whole categories which is very difficult for a migrant to answer. Is he a minor? So this one you will find it. Then you have a whole range we classify. If you go to migrated, there is a whole explanation. There is a whole range. There is the whole vocabulary of traveling, which is going to be sort of a huge vocabulary. You have the whole vocabulary of danger, which is very different if you are in the border of Italy, for example, in Briançon. You have then the whole topography of the mountain, how to reach. But if you are in Calais, you have a totally different kind of vocabulary, which is linked to the sea, which is linked to, you know, so it depends very much. It is situated. So, and then you have the whole question of family, which you have a strong psychological vocabulary also. So you can search by words, and we have been trying to show how each culture is going to explain the loss, who is going to explain the death, who is going to explain the prayer. So this was the point. And what was interesting is that we didn't keep French or English as a pivot language. We just were with the languages without any pivot to translate. So it's a whole question of translation. I agree very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not a scientist, but I'm a fervent reader, among other things, English. And what I found very, I found your intervention and your topic of study extremely interesting, and it reminds me very much that I enjoyed reading some writers who show us that neither the phenomenon of migration is so new, doesn't belong only to apartheid, or the mixing of languages. One of such authors is Amitav Ghosh and his fantastic Yiddish trilogy. And he's got the whole glossary of,
yes.
I don't know if it's a researched mixed language or mixed languages or a little bit invented, but it's fantastic. It's the Lascar language, the Lascar seamen of the Malabar coast, who apparently were the first Indian settlers in the UK, or the Canton Chinese pigeon, Chinese English, or a similar mixed language of the Mauritians, of the inhabitants of Mauritius, which I'm talking about in English. Another such author which reflects the very early migrations in Europe in the Middle Ages is Umberto Eco in Il Nome della Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
There were several monks who moved around old monasteries, in Europe, and would forget their native language and started including terms and words from other languages. One of them I remember is a certain Salvatore, who spoke a language who everybody understood, but he was a mixture of English, French, German, Italian. So to say, just to reflect the idea that it's an old phenomenon and very enjoyable one, I would say, in the research and in reading also in literature. So thank you.
Yes, this is an endless horizon.
Yeah.
Literature and migration, but I'm not sure that you can just say literature and migration. It's more intriguing than that. Any other question from the floor? Well, if not, I have to thank everyone for being here, and of course, Guinevere for coming from Marseille to Paris, for addressing us, and all those who have thankfully accepted my invitation to share their views on this important topic. And of course, the session was basically dedicated to words, keywords, vocabulary, or whatever. But it's very important. And you may have seen in the program that there was a participant to be confirmed, Charlotte Foucault-Quillon, who unfortunately for us is abroad today. And this question of vocabulary was of particular interest as far as she's concerned, because she is advising this association called DisinFox Migration. And you are on the board, I think, Catherine. And of course, from, should I say, a citizen perspective, not necessarily a militant perspective, but the question of disinformation on migration in Japan is absolutely decisive. We know how all that is being instrumentalized, and not only by the extreme right, really, unfortunately, and which means, of course, that what we have addressed, what you have addressed today, is something which will remain a key topic, both for the migrants themselves and for the scientists, but also, I think, for the citizen. And here, perhaps, the comparative perspective about how countries are more or less open or non-open to migration. It would have been interesting, for instance, to have a view from Japan, which is supposed not to be very open to migration, except that now they need migration. And this question of, well, I mean, there are too many migrants, but just imagine if there were no migrants. And this also, of course, has an impact on what we may call perhaps the hypocrisy of government about having vote-catching political discourse on the one hand. And I mean, what was said about Giscard d'Estaing, if I'm not wrong, Giscard was also the president who decided to accept the family regrouping.
Absolute reunification.
So that's why probably he has been accused later on to be a part of the invasion.
Yes.
But he was innocent.
Now.
So here we are really in the real life of government and politicians. And so we have just opened the topic. Thanks to you. Thank you very much, Zanabir, and thank you, all of you, for this rich and diversified panel. And thank you for those who took the care to share the room with us. And of course, thank you to Gwenaël, because we have been your guest. So thank you for your hospitality. And next time without technical problems. Okay. Thank you very much. And Gwenaël, thank you. Yeah, thank you as well.